Okay, beautiful people. Let's finish off our consideration of HIV, and then we'll move on to cancer. We've looked at three classes of drugs that target the HIV virus. And I want to just show you some data. I think this is in your handout, and if it isn't, don't worry about it. But it shows the impact of protease inhibitors on the treatment of HIV. And let me just translate this for you. Here's the prevalence of HIV. There are probably 400, 500,000 people in the United States. This is all U.S. data infected. In the mid-90s, I want to say 93, 94, 95, protease inhibitors were introduced into therapy, and the introduction of these drugs into therapy had a dramatic effect on the incidence of HIV infections, down to about 45,000 new cases every year, and on the deaths resulting from HIV. In other words, when protease inhibitors were incorporated in the protocols, they had dramatic effects. In fact, such dramatic effects that over the last, let's just say, 10 years, in Western society, HIV has gone from a death sentence to a chronic disease. And that's raised all kinds of health issues, public health issues, etc. And it's because these drugs are effective at suppressing the virus, not eliminating it, but suppressing the virus, allowing the immune system to recover to the point that the patient is functional. So, how are these drugs used? They are used in two ways. They are frequently referred to as HART, or highly, have you heard that term?
Yeah, okay, you have.
Highly active antiretroviral therapy. Basically, this is combination therapy, okay? There are two basic templates for the use of these drugs. One template is to use two of the nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitors along with a protease inhibitor. I'm going to be a bit cynical here, but this is the protocol that someone in the West would be given in terms of treatment. West equals wealth. Okay? There is a second protocol that involves two nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitors plus a non-nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitor. And now you can choose and put into these boxes drugs from these classes of drugs. In other words, one may use AZT, one may use lamivudine, That's way beyond what you need to know. But these are the basic. And this is used in primarily the developing world because it's a less expensive treatment protocol. These protocols or these drugs are now made generically, primarily by patent breaking, in order to deal with the epidemic that is before us. And these drugs are also formulated as a single pill, so the patient doesn't have to take multiple drugs. And if you're talking in a developed world where compliance becomes a huge problem, this becomes a factor. So this is how these drugs are used. And I guess my comment to you is you will never use them unless you become an infectious disease person specializing in HIV. But you will have patients that are taking them, and you need to know the baggage they carry in terms of side effects. Yes?
So I'm going to ask something that I know is kind of would take us off course.
That's all right.
Looking at more of a general it seems to me, I did HIV research for several years in undergrad. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I'm like, is it worth, like, spending this life working on these drugs for people who all they have to do is change their lifestyle, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so is this, like, a big ethical debate, or is it, like, not really, the doctors not really think about it?
I think people that are active in the area, okay, I don't know to what extent you're familiar, but the School of Medicine has a program in Kenya. And the Kenya Partnership or Kenya Project is very big into HIV treatment. Just started in 2000. They're treating 50,000 patients in Western Kenya, about 19 different clinical sites. And Dr. Joel Mamlin, who heads that up in Kenya, was here just a month ago. And basically, let me tell you what he said to about 900 people at a banquet in Indianapolis. We're failing. The rate of infection is greater than the number of people being treated. This is a losing battle. And therefore, the strategy has to change. Treatment isn't, you know, and what do doctors do? Judas, they diagnose and treat. That's what they've been trained to do, okay? But they're not going to win this battle. They're not going to get out of this dilemma by diagnosing and treating. There have to be some fundamental changes. And one of the approaches that they are going to start to institute is, and you get into all kinds of issues of testing, cultural customs, etc., is to find out the status in a village. Let's just pick a village. The status of every person in that village. Now, you know those that are so bad that they have gone to the health center for treatment, but you don't know the status of others in the village, and they may not know their status. And once that status is known, positive or negative, do everything you possibly can to prevent that person from becoming infected or prevent that infected person from passing on the infection. There are huge ethical problems, but it's beyond what I'm able to teach, okay? But let me just show you the cost in America. You don't write any of this down, okay? You know this, and it's changing as I speak. But it costs roughly $25,000 a year medically to manage an HIV patient. And if you just look, this is CD4 count. Just for those of you that may not know, AIDS is defined as a CD4 count of less than 200. So anything above 200 is non-AIDS or pre-AIDS. And so CD4 count, less than 300, 200, now we're into AIDS. And what you see is increasingly the cost associated with other health care beyond drugs goes up as the quality of the immune system of the patient decreases, they become susceptible to a whole variety of opportunistic infections. As you know, I teach undergrads, and you're not much different, okay? Nor am I, okay? And one of the statements that I show them, this is the last lecture, the last day, the last statement, okay? It was something you just alluded to. This is out of a review article that Anthony Fucci wrote. Unlike microbial scourges such as malaria and tuberculosis that you now know everything about, for which there is very little that people can do to prevent infection. There are some things that they can do, but not a lot. Get this. HIV infection in adults is 100% preventable by behavior modification. The AIDS community got it. Behavior modification in many cultures and in developing countries is an enormous problem to overcome. And that's the ethical dilemma. And this is the point. Unless methods of prevention, because you're not going to treat your way out of this problem, with or without a vaccine are successful, the worst of the global pandemic will occur in the 21st century. Or, translated, you ain't seen anything yet. And as a result, the implications of this disease on all people, not just the individual, not just the family, but the culture, the society, Who's dying? I know, again, keep going back to Kenya, but that's what I'm familiar with. It's young people that are dying. The workforce, the future of the country is dying. The young people that are in various forms of employment, professional people, etc. Well, not to depress you, what I'd like to do is segue now to at least introduce from viruses to cancer. And there are a lot of challenges, issues, related phenomenon that we're going to address, and we'll be doing this for a bit. Just by way of background, there are about 1 million cases of cancer diagnosed annually in the United States. It's estimated that the likelihood of each of us receiving a diagnosis of cancer is about 25%. 1 in 4 will receive that diagnosis in their lifetime. Most of the people that receive that diagnosis will receive drugs for treatment. Maybe a quarter of the people that get a diagnosis can be treated successfully with surgery and/or radiation. The vast majority will require both surgery, or may require surgery, radiation, as well as the use of cancer drugs. And so understanding these drugs and how they work becomes important. The disease, or I might say, let me just show you, this is out of the New York Times just last week, okay? There is some good news in the cancer area. And again, this is for edification, okay? And that is, if you look at cancer rates, and you can look at it in various contexts, all cancers, both sexes, this is number of deaths per 100,000, okay, is the measure referred to here. Number of cancers in men dropping, women dropping, all cancers dropping. If you look, lung cancer in men dropping. In fact, the rates here are about a little over 2% per year. Prostate dropping, breast dropping, lung cancer in women going up. And that's because more women are smoking than before. On the whole, the news is fairly encouraging, and probably it's encouraging because detection occurs earlier, treatment is initiated earlier, and there are means of preventing. Well, what we are going to do when we consider cancer drugs is somewhat similar to what we did with viruses. We're going to look first, and that's what we're going to focus on this morning. The principles that underlie the use of these drugs. There are some principles that are very unique to the use of anti-cancer drugs. And then we're going to relate the use of these drugs to the cell cycle kinetics of cell division. We're going to identify the major classes and how they work. We're going to look at what are the toxicities and how do cancers, or how do neoplastic cells become resistant. When you think of cancer, there is a lot of similarity between the treatment of a neoplasm and the treatment of a bacterial infection. In both cases, you're trying to kill a rapidly dividing cell without damaging the host. You're trying to achieve selective toxicity. As we saw with bacteria, the bacteria had various ways of neutralizing or becoming resistant to the drug. So cancer cells have an array of mechanisms to neutralize or become resistant to the poison that's threatening their existence. And as we saw with bacteria, there were a variety of species or types. So with cancer, there are a variety of types of cancers that will have differing sensitivities to the drugs that we're going to consider. The flip side is there are significant differences between the treatment of a bacterial infection and the treatment of a neoplastic infection. And that is where the body has a defense, the immune system responds to a bacterial infection. That is not the case with neoplastic diseases. The body does not, or the immune system does not mount a response. And therefore, if one is going to cure a cancer, one has to be able to achieve what is referred to as total cell kill, elimination of every single last neoplastic cell in that patient. And secondly, we, in treating bacterial infections, were able to exploit qualitative differences between a bacteria and a host cell. Just for an example, the cell wall. When one is dealing with cancer, one is exploiting quantitative differences, primarily differences in rate of cell division. And so we will see cells that are rapidly multiplying, neoplastic cells that are rapidly multiplying are more sensitive to these drugs than cells that are not, or more slowly dividing. The hooker is, many cells in your body are rapidly multiplying, and these drugs, for all practical purposes, cannot discriminate, have a very steep dose response curve, have a therapeutic index of 1.00000. The dose that's effective causes significant toxicity. And so as we begin to look at the drugs, what we are going to see is that these drugs and how they are used are aimed at maximizing cell destruction and minimizing toxicity to the patient. Now, in terms of principles that underlie the use of these drugs, I've alluded to one. Rapidly dividing tumors are more sensitive to these drugs than slowly dividing tumors. Certain leukemias, certain testicular cancers are more responsive to these drugs than slow-growing tumors of the colon or the breast. That is, rapidly growing tumors have what is referred to a high growth fraction. That is, the percentage of cells, the percentage of viable cells that are in active cell division. Now, cancer cells and the kinetics by which they grow and multiply have been studied extensively. And what is known is that cancer cells multiply or divide, and they do so logarithmically at a rate that as they become larger or the tumor burden increases, slows. This is a measure of tumor burden or number of cells logarithmic. And what you see is as the tumor burden, as the number of neoplastic cells grows, the rate at which it grows is slowing. This is the result of the tumor not having access to oxygen and nutrients because of inadequate vascularization. It's estimated that one can detect, just for argument's sake, a tumor when it reaches the size of about a gram or maybe a small grape, it is detectable. That tumor has about 10 to the 9 cells at this point. It's undergone 30 cell divisions. So at the point the tumor is detected, 30 cell divisions have taken place, and one has, to a degree, missed an opportune window for treatment because the cell now is slowing. Once that tumor is detected, most likely because the patient begins to exhibit some symptoms, then a very fundamental decision has to be made based on the kind of tumor, the location of the tumor, etc. Are you going to go for a cure, or are you going to institute palliative care? If the decision is made that the tumor is advanced, the tumor is not going to respond, one needs to make the patient as comfortable as possible. One can do this by administering cancer chemotherapeutic drugs, but administer them to a degree or an extent that alleviates some of the symptoms without maximizing or significantly increasing the toxicity to the patient. And one can get minimal decrease in tumor burden, but ultimately the patient succumbs. If the treatment is curative, then there's two approaches. One approach depends on the nature of the tumor. So if you have a liquid tumor, a leukemia, let's say, a disseminated tumor, one can administer regimens, and we'll see this once we learn the drugs, regimens that are given at various intervals that reduce over time that tumor burden to the point that there are no longer cells, neoplastic cells, in the patient. Now, just remember here, you don't have to go very far before the patient is asymptomatic. So these protocols involve a number of drugs that work by different mechanisms that have minimal overlapping toxicities that are given according to certain specific protocols to the patient. If you're dealing with a tumor that's solid, one can surgically or via radiation reduce that tumor burden. If it's surgically removable or reducible, that's one option. If not, radiation may reduce that tumor burden, and then cancer chemotherapy can commence. There's several other now principles that are involved in how these drugs are used. And they come from a study of cell cycle kinetics. If you look at neoplastic cells and their response to cancer drugs, one of the observations that is made is that cancer drugs kill or destroy neoplastic cells following first-order kinetics. That is, with every treatment, a given dose of drug destroys a constant fraction of cells. This is referred to as the log cell kill hypothesis. So if you have a population of cells, every time those cells are exposed to a dose of the drug, a constant specific fraction of the cells are destroyed. Let me give you an example. Let's use leukemia as an example. Patient becomes diagnosed with leukemia. The patient has 10 to the 9 leukemia cells. And you have a drug, a miracle drug. Okay, this is hypothetical. A miracle drug that's 99.999% effective. It will kill when these 10 to the 9 cells are exposed to this drug, 5 logs of cells. So you will reduce the tumor burden from 10 to the 9 to 10 to the 4. patient's going to be asymptomatic. There will still be 10 to the 4 cells that remain in that patient, necessitating another cycle, another cycle, another cycle, another cycle. Here's the reality. You never get a drug that has a 5-log kill capability. You kill the patient, okay? So the alternative is to use less drug, combination drug to decrease the emergence of resistance and the increase in toxicity. The other aspect related to the cell cycle that's going to become important is certain neoplastic cells only work when the cell is at a certain stage or passing through a certain stage in the cell cycle. Now, if we just look at the cell cycle, this is simply a depiction thereof, and let's just pick it up at the point that a cell has divided. Mitosis is complete. That newly divided cell has an option. It can go into a resting state, or the G sub zero phase. These tend to be resistant to most neoplastic agents. Or it can commence the process of dividing. And so if it continues to divide, this newly formed cell moves into the G1 phase, where the machinery required for synthesis of DNA takes place, followed by the S phase, where DNA copying takes place, followed by the G2, and then finally mitosis, the ordered division of the cell. There are anti-neoplastic cells that work at the S phase. There are anti-neoplastic cells that drugs that inhibit mitosis. And we say such drugs are cell cycle dependent. And there's some examples here. Bleomycin, vinca alkaloids are good examples thereof. And any of the drugs that inhibit or interfere with the ability of the cell to synthesize DNA. Then there are cells or drugs that are able to inhibit the cell in any stage of its cycle, and these are referred to as cell cycle nonspecific, and they encompass a variety of drugs, all of which, even though not indicated here, all of which are alkylating agents. But alkylating agents, cisplatin, which alkylates, nitrosourea, which alkylate, and some of the antibiotics, work anywhere, any stage of the cell cycle. So it's going to be a convenient way for us to pigeonhole, to classify, to make some sense out of this smorgasbord collage of drugs that are used to treat cancer. Now, if drugs work best when cell is multiplying, if drugs work best when there is, as referred to here, a high growth fraction, when in the tumor a large percent of cells are in the process of dividing, then toxicity is going to be most manifested at those sites or in those tissues that have rapidly dividing cells. So that because these agents do not discriminate. So the therapy aimed at rapidly dividing cells is going to lead to toxic effects in rapidly dividing host cells. And what might they be? Well, the buccal mucosa, the GI tract, ulceration, not at all uncommon, bone marrow depression, you will hear over and over and over again, hair follicles, loss of hair, alopecia, germinal epithelium, infertility, as some examples of rapidly dividing host cells that are highly sensitive to the toxic effects. I alluded to the fact that neoplastic cells, much like bugs, have developed ways to neutralize, to diminish the presence of poisons in their environment. As we saw, bacteria had an array of resistant tools or mechanisms, so neoplastic cells. And in fact, resistance is the greatest obstacle to successful therapy in the treatment of cancer. And so what are these mechanisms? And we'll come back again and talk about these specifically. But there are four, maybe five specific ways used in combination that neoplastic cells have to negate the effect of a cytotoxic agent. One mechanism is to repair the damage. We'll see this with alkylating agents that alkylate DNA. The site of damage is repaired before the damaged site can lead to a cytotoxic effect in the cell. Many of these are going to be positively charged species or alkylating agents, and they can be ion trapped by various sulfhydryl compounds that will chemically neutralize, chemically react with the alkylating agent. Changes in target enzyme, we saw it with bugs, we saw it with protozoa, we're going to see it with cancer. An example, again, being dihydrofolate reductase, because that is a potential target. And then drug activation. Some of these drugs, in order to become effective, require kinases to activate the drug. Altered kinase activity, decreased activation, ineffectiveness of the drug. And then finally, and we'll see as we get farther in, more importantly, various cells in our body have a protein called P-glycoprotein. This is a transmembrane protein that functions along with ATP as fuel as an efflux pump. It is the product of a gene called the multidrug resistant gene. In the presence, the level of this P-glycoprotein in cells varies from organ system to organ system. In the presence of toxins, for example, cancer drugs, the gene can be upregulated. There is increased number of efflux pumps at the surface of the neoplastic cell that efflux pump out certain drugs. And the drugs that are substrates for this pump tend to be planar drugs. They tend to be positively charged or basic drugs. And they are typified by some really important cancer drugs. Bleomycin, doxorubicin, you'll know all of these in time. This is a major mechanism for multiple drug resistance because this pump does not just pump one, but pumps a number of important anti-cancer drugs. Okay, before we quit, let me just set the stage and introduce for you one type of drug, and then we'll stop for the day. There are various ways to organize these, drugs, they are put into big boxes and there are subtypes. But clearly one major class of drugs are called alkylating agents. And they all work by the same basic mechanism. And that is, here's the drug. That drug somehow is converted to a carbon-deficient species, if you like, a carbonium ion, but that may not be the species, but some carbon-deficient species, or electron-deficient species, that then can chemically react with an electron-rich species, an electron-rich site, forming R, and this could be a protein, this could be DNA, a nucleotide in DNA, forming a covalent bond. So alkylating agents become activated to a species that can covalently react with macromolecules. The one class of alkylating agents, and we'll look at several, are a class of drugs called nitrogen mustards. And nitrogen mustards are drugs, and there's several examples thereof. We'll talk about two, but one is typified by mechloroethamine. This class of drugs grew out of an observation made in the First World War. There were chemical warfare agents that were used called mustard gases. And mustard gases basically have this chemical structure. And soldiers that were killed by exposure to this or these mustard gases had decreased lymphoid tissue, decreased lymphoid mass, dissolution of lymphoid tissue, aplasia of the bone marrow, etc. That observation led to the idea of designing a mustard-type alkylating agent. Now, as you know, sulfur's divalent. In order to exploit this example and have any variety, they made not sulfur containing mustards, but nitrogen-containing mustards, and that's the example here of mechloroethamine. And if you look at it carefully, this is the nitrogen mustard. It has two arms, a right arm and a left arm, that are identical, and it has then, nitrogen being trivalent, in the case of mechloroethamine, a methyl group here. There have literally been hundreds of these made, and all have different R groups here. The simplest is mechloroethamine, and it's typified here. Here's how it works. We'll come back and touch this on Monday. This drug is given intravenously. It's a vesicant. It is a very difficult drug to administer to the patient. It is given intravenously, and it undergoes loss of a chlorine. We're trying to get here. Loss of a chlorine to produce this ammonium ion that can exist either in a cyclic form or as the free carbonium ion. So here we are. So once it forms the alkylating species, it is seeking out sites or molecules that are electron-rich. And one of the electron-rich sites is the 7-position of guanine. And it forms, hola, a covalent bond at that site. And that covalent bond causes the guanine to tautomerize, and we're going to see that plays a role in the ultimate effect. Since this drug has two arms, it's just utilized or consumed the right arm, it still has, or the left arm, it still has a right arm. So it can, once again, produce a carbonium ion and alkylate another guanine residue at position 7. So here's a guanine in one strand of DNA, here's a guanine in another strand of DNA. The result is the drug can cross-link DNA, making it non-functional. It can also, so that's when the bifunctional, the two arms can cross-link. It can also simply monoalkylate, cause a change in the guanine such that it mispairs. That is, it no longer pairs with cytosine, but now it pairs with thymidine. And finally, and that screws up the functioning of the DNA that ultimately brings about a cytotoxic effect in the cell. Well, when these cells become alkylated, when DNA becomes alkylated, there are various mechanisms triggered to excise, remove, break down the DNA that leads to removal of purines, removal of pyrimidines, and we will see depurination also becomes a factor. The first two, and specifically the first one, is the most important. Alkylation leads to cross-linking of DNA, leads to dysfunctional DNA such that the cell no longer can divide and it dies. And so will I if I continue. So have a great weekend and I will see you Monday. Let me just tell you what's ahead, if you can just cool it a second, because it's some good things. Monday will be the final quiz. I'm not giving any more. I thought it was cruel and unusual quizzing to do it after Thanksgiving. So there'll be no quiz, okay? But here's the deal. Here's the deal. We are going to open up the site where you do teacher evaluations, and we're going to ask you, I think I'll have that baby open today if I get upstairs and talk to Jackie, but shortly. We're going to ask you to evaluate my teaching and Dr. Watkins' teaching. You know that you've done this. And in exchange for that, we will give you a free quiz when you sign a piece of paper saying you have done it, and we'll do that a week from Wednesday, which will, the Wednesday, where are we, Judas? 2 weeks from today. Okay? Oh, have you? Oh, I didn't know it was open. Oh, okay, here's what we want. In exchange for a free quiz, you do our evaluations. So we will have a quiz on Monday that will involve antiviral therapy, period. We will not have a quiz the Monday after Thanksgiving. We will have a class the Monday after Thanksgiving, but certainly not a quiz.